I've named this, starting at chapter 4:1, a right perspective, and I think it's important as we read this book to say to ourselves again, this book's asking me what I really believe. Because as he says things like it's all meaningless, we know the times that we struggle with our faith. When I was coming home from Kenya to study psychology, I came home because I felt there was a real need for someone to be trained to help missionaries when they were going through really hard problems. When I was going through a hard time, I didn't know who to talk to. I felt a real need for someone who was trained to help me, and I didn't find it, and that put a real burden on my heart. So I announced to our mission, I'm going home and I'm going to study psychology, and our leader in Kenya at the time said, "Don't do it, sister, don't do it. Why? It'll destroy your faith." And that made me a bit scared, and I wondered how I'd go, but I could only say that it was just like the book of psychology, the book of Ecclesiastes, "What do you believe?" And I came out of that course stronger than ever. I had been taught by people who were teaching us on relationships. The head of our department got married for the 7th time to a student. And they were teaching us intimate relationships. I could see that it was valuable to study psychology, and that that there's lots and lots and lots we can learn. And I was really sad when it ended, because I enjoyed it so much. But the answers to life come from God's word and from trusting in Christ. So there were no answers to life's problems, but there's wonderful things to learn about how the brain works, how the mind works, and that kind of thing. So I'd do it again. I mean, there's lots of it that went right over my head that I'd love to have another go at, but it was a wonderful time. And this is what this book's saying too. What do you really believe? Is it good to dig down and say, what do I believe, or will I just go on the way I am, never thinking very deeply about it? I was talking to someone the other day who'd had a lot of pain in his life, and he said, I just think it's better to forget it. It's past and gone. I know that he has a lot of anger, and that this anger comes out over and over again, but he doesn't want the cost of dealing with some of the grief of the past. And Socrates said, the unexamined life isn't worth living. And so I said to him, I don't agree with you, but I think that this is what Ecclesiastes do. It gets underneath our skin and says, what do you believe? And in chapter 4, verse 1, it says, again I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of their oppressors, and they have no comforter. As we were driving down this morning, on the news it said that there has been some controversy in Japan, because the doctors in Japan don't believe in telling people when they've got terminal illness. And one person was suing a doctor because he told her that she had gallbladder trouble when she had cancer, and she went around the world on a trip and so on. That was a court case. But the news reader said, in Japan they don't believe in life after death, and so it's so painful to be told that you're dying. I'm not sure that they don't all believe in life after death, but that's what he said. And I just thought, well, that's really interesting, because in some ways that's what... when you look at life under the sun, it's just as though this life is all there is, and that's not what, that is the opposite to what we're saying. If this life is all there is, then it is meaningless. But because it's not, then there's wonderful hope. And another interesting current thing is this week's Time magazine. The cover story is Hitler, the evil that won't die, and it's all about some of the things that are happening in the world today. 50 years ago, we celebrated, some of us celebrated victory in Europe, and the fact that Hitler was dead, and that we thought the Third Reich was over, but it crops up over and over again. And in this article there's a picture of some young American fanatics doing the Heil Hitler thing on Martin Luther King Day, and the hatred on their faces. And we're seeing it even in Australia, people that are arming themselves in this fascist way. And we're saying, what's happening in Bosnia? We could say, well, what's happening in Rwanda? That's Africa. And they do that kind of thing. They have kind of tribal warfare. But what about Bosnia and Chechnya and what we saw of the destruction of Grozny? And look at the buildings, historical, wonderful buildings that are being destroyed. It's not just Africa. The horrors on the subway in Tokyo, the multi-storey building bombed in Oklahoma. And when the news of the Holocaust broke on the world and they realised the extent of the genocide, everyone said it must never happen again. But we know what's happening in Rwanda, and we know that it could happen again in Burundi now, but what can we do? It is happening again. And so we see the seasons come and go. As Kath read us in chapter 1, the sun rises and the sun sets and all these things just come on. And is this kind of thing just going to come and happen again and again? Because the human heart is the same, and people react to situations often in these kind of cruel ways. I read in New Life yesterday that they're having mass crucifixions in the churches in Sudan. The Arab North in Sudan is determined to destroy the church in the south. And in Iran, two of the leaders of the church were killed last year. In Pakistan, they had heresy trials of young male believers. They were acquitted, but again in New Life yesterday it said they're being hunted. They've escaped Pakistan and they're being hunted. And some of the commentators say that this part of chapter 4 is the lowest part in the book. I saw the tears of the oppressed and they had no comforter. Power was on the side of their oppressors. When we read about what was happening in Uganda in the time of Idi Amin, it certainly did seem that power was on the side of the oppressor. But that one quote that Kath made from Derek Kidner will be made clear to us one day, that there will be unquestionable answers to the questions that we have now. Why? I often say to God, if you love those people in Rwanda as much as you love me, why is this happening? Why are children seeing their parents murdered? Why are people being battered to death? Somalia has broken my heart. That was where I worked for 23 years, and to come home and see on the TV last year and the year before, knowing how hard life was for them, that they've lost so much. They've lost their schools and their university and their hospitals, and they've gone back 20 or 30 years, and they didn't have it good before. It was hard then. Why is it happening? But when we know some of the miracles that are happening in some of these places, we realise that God is at work and that the half is not being told to us. And I just wanted to share one example. When I was in Kenya, I was working for the Somali radio program. We had to leave Somalia because it turned communist. We went into Ethiopia. They had a war and we had to leave there. And we were broadcasting into Somalia over the Far Eastern Broadcasting Association, and working with us was a group broadcasting into Ethiopia in Amharic. Amharic's the language of Ethiopia. And so to do that, you need nationals willing to have their voice come over the broadcast, which could mean that they could be objects of terrorism if it ever got out whose voice it was. And they were wondering where on earth they'd get someone who'd be willing to be the voice of the Ethiopian Christian program. And one day a young man arrived out of the blue. Someone told him that there were people in our organisation that knew Amharic, and his name was Lulu. And he came and he talked to us, and he said that he'd be willing to help. And someone said, well, how did you become a Christian? He said, I was in the university in Addis Ababa a few years ago, and I was a communist. I thought that communism was the answer, and all my friends were communists. And periodically they would send us down to the rural areas to find the churches and to close the churches, to persecute the Christians and to see that those churches were closed. And in the days when, after 1974, when communism was so strong in Ethiopia, hundreds and hundreds, probably thousands of churches were closed and people had to worship God in their homes. And that was part of Lulu's work, he and his friends. And he said, we went to this village and we sat in the service, and then at the end we stood up and we said, this church will be closed from now on. This will not be a church anymore, and anyone who comes here to worship will be put in prison, because the police were working with them. And the people sat there, shocked, overwhelmed. And then before they had a chance to get out, a lady stood up and she said, well, before we go, I want to pray for you. I want to pray for us and I want to pray for you. And this lady stood up and she prayed and she asked God's blessing on the lives of these young people. And then she asked them home for lunch. And they said, oh, well, we were hungry and we thought we might as well eat there. So they went home and they put it in Ethiopia. They have a food called injera bawat, which is a great big pancake that looks like a grey chamois, and they put this hot chilli sauce on it, and you tear the pancake and dip it in the sauce. And once you get to know it, you crave it. When you first start, it's very hot. Anyway, when they saw it, it was a really lovely meal she put down, and they started to put their hands on it. She said, wait a minute, here we thank God for our food. And she prayed again. She thanked the Lord for providing the food, and she prayed for them. And they went away, but they were fairly subdued. Well, Lulu said that that was the beginning for him. The weeks and the months went by, but he couldn't get this woman's face out of his mind. She was put in prison. She was beaten. But he couldn't forget her. And he became a Christian through other events, but that was the beginning. And he was the voice going out over the radio, taking the Christian message into Ethiopia. Power was with him. He was an oppressor. And here it says power was on the side of their oppressors. They could close churches. They had the power of the government. They had the police coming behind them, fulfilling their orders, closing the churches, putting prisoners, Christians in jail. But the real power was something that they weren't aware of, the power of a woman's faith to stand up and witness, the power of a woman who believed in God and who would not be subdued. And that's only one tiny little example, but as we read about what's happening in these countries, we see that power is not with the oppressor. They are allowed to do things, but God has told us in his word that he is able to make all these things work out for good. And what amazes me, and we'll be doing this a bit more in the next chapter, is how it's these churches, like the church in Ethiopia, that are the strong churches in the world today. The church in Ethiopia is doubled under communism. In chapter 5, verse 8, it carries on that same theme. If you see the poor oppressed in a district and justice and rights denied, do not be surprised at such things. One official is eyed by a higher one. The increase of the land is taken by all. The king himself profits from the fields. And we know that Solomon put heavy taxes on the people and conscripted even his own people to work in his palace. He lived in utter luxury, but that was at the cost of the poor people. And when we read about feudal systems and what goes on in countries like Ethiopia, where an island, and in the past in other parts of Europe, the people were barely getting enough to eat, while the squire or the landlord or the feudal owner lived in absolute luxury. And last week, one of the testimonies at the weekend was a lady who got up and she wept through the whole testimony. She just cried and cried. And she told the story of her life. She lost 4 babies. Then they adopted 3 girls, and then they had 3 boys. They had a sheep farm, and they were doing really well till the drought came. She had a live-in housekeeper. Children went to boarding school. Her husband was a really good farmer, and they loved what they were doing. She said, everything that we were doing was for the children. She said, my girls walked after sheep from the time they were 18 months old. But when the drought came, they had to borrow money to get food for the animals, and then they couldn't get any more, and he shot 10,500 sheep. And then they lost their property. They walked off it with nothing. And then one of the grandchildren died of cot death, and she said that was the last straw. Bruce and I couldn't talk about it, and we nearly split up. We'd gone through all that together, but when the grandchild died, we just seemed to have this wall between us where we couldn't talk. They broke through it. One night she said to him, "I don't need you to be refusing to talk to me," and that broke the dam, and he cried and cried, and they talked and they... But he is driving a council truck. They live at the weekend in a little borrowed house on a farm, and in the week, while he's driving the truck, they're in a caravan. Imagine from the huge property to that and the pain. And she said, really, the people that we owed money to, the finance company, tricked us out of our property. I don't know the details, but when you read this, if you see the poor oppressed in a district and justice and rights denied, don't be surprised at such things. Last night on Ray Martin, there was people talking about being put off their farm by the bank, and and 2 days later the father died of a heart attack, and then when they appealed it was found out it was an error. And so we're hearing things like that. And the only thing you can say is that we look to God. And Jesus said over and over again, your treasure is not on this earth, it's in heaven. And if we think, well, I'm building this farm for my girls, but you don't know if you'll have it. And so although God gives us these things to enjoy, we have to hold them with open hands because we don't know. And in Psalm 119 verse 50 it says, my comfort in my suffering is this, your promise preserves my life. In Isaiah 25:8, the sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces. He will remove the disgrace of his people from off the earth. And that is quoted again in Revelation 7 when it says that the people... one of the elders said, who are they in white robes? These are they who have come out of the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. They are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will spread his tent over them. Never again will they hunger, never will they thirst. The sun will not beat on them, nor any scorching heat. For the Lamb at the centre of the throne will be their shepherd. He will lead them to springs of water, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. It's all forgotten. And whether you think the church is still going through the tribulation or not, that was a huge discussion and arguing when I was at Bible College in the late 1950s. Now they hardly even talk about it. And I think if our principal wrote up something about the church will go through the tribulation in my day, there would have been a brick through it. Now it's a non-issue, but whatever we believe, some people are going through terrible times in the world today and suffering. And when you think of the church in Sudan and Rwanda and Angola and some of these places, they are going through tribulation, and yet one day God will wipe those tears away. Then we go on to chapter 4, verse 4. And I saw that all labour and all achievements spring from man's envy of his neighbour. This too is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I suppose we get the feeling when we're going through someone's beautiful house when it's really lovely, and you think, oh boy, I'd like one like that. That's giving me some ideas of... I mean, we'd be happy if we got time to do the vacuuming, but... But he's talking about a restless desire to outclass others, trying to keep up with the Joneses, the sort of things that make us envy, and we're all different. There'll be areas that we envy. I mean, if I see someone really slim and their flaks look even a bit loose, there springs up a pang of envy. How did they do it? Other people might see someone else's kids really academically achieving, and we think, I don't know, we're all different. But Hyacinth was sitting up in bed the other night with with hair in rollers and a nightcap on, and she was talking about neighbours that got burgled. And she said to Richard, who was trying to go to sleep, "What right did they have to be burgled? They don't have objet d'art like we do." Is that the French pronunciation? Objet d'art. That means what? D'art. No T. And he said, "And what objet d'art do we have?" And she said, "Richard, my Royal Dalton." And she was envying people down the street being burgled because that meant that the burglar must have thought they had something to pinch. So when our labour and achievement is springing from envy of someone else, that is meaningless and chasing after wind, because there'll always be someone with a better house or better figure or whatever, and it's just wasting our time. And then he goes on to look at the fool who gives up in apathy and inertia. He folds his hands and he thinks, "Well, I'll just drop out of it. It's not worth it. There's no point in trying." That's one side of it. The other side is two handfuls with toil, chasing after the wind, the workaholic. So we've got on one side the fool who's a dropout and who can't be bothered, and on the other side this frantic activity. No time to read Kath's book. No time to no time for the garden. No time for the vacuuming. No, I think I should ring her up, but she'll talk too long, so it's too busy. It's awful that you don't have time to do things that would be really nice to do. When I was a missionary, I'd come home for a year, I'd see everyone, I'd go and stay with them, I kept up with my letters, and now I'm home, there are people in Newcastle I don't even see from one year to the next, and it's too busy. So there's got to be, and so the middle part is, what he talks about is, better one hand with tranquility. So better than just giving up and say, "Well, what's the point?" or racing around with two hands full of toil, one hand with tranquility. And Moffat's translation says, "A handful of contentment is better than two hands full of toil and futile effort." And I was thinking about taking control, learning to say no. Who's good at it? Some have learned. It's really hard, and it seems like they go for the really busy ones because they're already in racing mode too, and they'll probably get it done. Oh, no trouble. And it just gets into their program. And so the more you do, the more you seem to get asked to do. So being willing at the beginning of the year or the beginning of the week to block out the time in your diary that is for your family, for your time of reflection, for your time for your hobby, for the times that you need. And that's what I was talking about spices last night. We've got to have a balance. We've got to have time to create. We've got to have time to share. We've got to have time for our friends. And if you don't block it out, it'll go. It won't be there. And then when someone says, can you do this, say no, that evening's taken, and you don't have to tell them why. You just say that time is taken up. And that's what we're trying to do. And one of the things that I think Ecclesiastes can help us with is getting our priorities straight. What are my priorities? What do I want to put my time into? Perhaps we're being taken up with things that are not priorities because we haven't taken that time to sit down and think about it. And that's what I think Socrates was saying. The unexamined life is not worth living. If we're not willing to sit down and say, "Well, what, you know, if I had a year to live, what would I do with that year?" Well, at the end, when I look back, am I going to be disappointed because of the things that I put my energy into were not my priorities? And there'll always be times when you're asked to do things and you do feel that you should do them, but there might be time that we can save for other things. He talks about, in verse 8, "There was a man all alone. He had neither son nor brother. There was no end to his toil, yet his eyes were not content with his wealth because there was no one there. There was no one to share. people, when Kath was working with cancer patients, quite a few of them said to her, "This cancer is the best thing that's ever happened to me because it's made me see what is real and important in my life, and that is my relationships. And in the time I have left, I want to spend it with the people I love." And so the meaning to life is the people that we love. And so often they get, their time is taken because we've got to get on with this and we've got to get on with that. "For whom am I toiling?" he asked. "And why am I depriving myself of enjoyment? This too is meaningless and miserable business." And so our number one priorities under our relationship with the Lord is enriching the relationships that we have. So he gives a little talk about that. Two are better than one because they have a good return for their work. If one falls down, his friend can help him up. But pity the man who falls and has no one to help him up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. And one of the commentaries I read is saying these two people are on a journey. The hazards of travel. It reminded me a bit of Pilgrim's Progress. As they were travelling, one fell down a pit and the other one helped him up. If one falls down, his friend can pull him out. Pity the one who falls down the pit and there's no one to pull him out. And then when they found somewhere to sleep, it was really cold, so they warmed each other up. While I was in Ethiopia, we were in an area where they had a flood and, it was a desert and they had never had enough rain, and they said, "We've got to pray for rain or the people aren't going to get a harvest," and we overdid it. And it rained and rained and rained, and there was 6 feet of water on our comp where we were living, and there were three single ladies in this area. The couple that worked with us had gone on holidays. They believed in the rapture. Every time something awful happened, this couple were on holiday. Anyway, for 4 days and nights we were up on this rock looking at this water where it had been desert. Here was all this water with tall trees just showing a little bit above the water. And at night it was absolutely freezing. And the day we got burnt and frizzled by the sun, and at night the mozzies had come and the freezing weather. And I remember this German lady about my age saying, "Look, this is a matter of survival. You'll have to hold me all night," and I really didn't want to. But I did, because I thought, well, this is survival. It's like when King David was dying and they said the poor old king needs someone to warm him up, and they found the most beautiful girl they could find, it called Abishag, and I thought about her that night and I thought, oh well, if Abishag could do it, I can. So they're on this journey, and one's fallen down a pit and got pulled out, and then they were cold, so they kept each other warm. And then marauders came, wayside marauders beat them up, but two could defend themselves. And but we know that how important it is to have a fellow traveller.
Would you please turn the tape over at this point?
And but we know that how important it is to have a fellow traveller. I had to go to England in February for a meeting about missionaries, pastoral care, and why missionaries come home early. And I would have been so excited if Kath had been going. We would have enjoyed it. It would have been great. But by myself, I'm thinking, oh, what if I can't find the place in Hong Kong that I'm supposed to go to? And what if no one will tell me where the right desk is and all that? And so it's really scary on your own. But you place to the Lord because you're saying, now, what will I do here? But I know it, when we're doing it together, how much better it is. And he says, a cord of three strands is not quickly broken. And the third strand is... our place where we work is called the Christian Synergy Centre. And synergy means the extra dimension of when we work together. We work with missions and we work with churches, adding to what they're doing. So when two people join forces, There's synergy, and that is the third strand, the richness. When people sing in harmony, the richness of those two voices coming, or the flute and the piano, or a couple where he's the big picture type who gets all the ideas and she's saying, but what if this happens? And she's not being a wet blanket, but she's helping to see that synergy, because together it is so much better than if he was doing it there and she was doing that, etc. So you know what I mean? The committee working together is synergy, because one's good at keeping the books and one's good at doing the flowers, and together it makes a beautiful harmony. And it's an engineering or a scientific term, but that's what God does. And the Holy Spirit for Christians is part of that synergy of blessing the work that these people are doing together. So a cord of three strands is not quickly broken. And again, I think of some of the examples of when there were relationship problems on the field, and what I read in one book was that if you get a bundle of twigs and tie them together, you can't break that. But what the enemy seeks to do is to separate, divide and conquer, because you can break one twig really easily. But when we're joined together, working in unity and seeing that the one we're trying to please is the Lord and not my little ideas, then it's much harder for that disunity to come in. Okay, 4:13. Better a poor but wise youth than an old but foolish king who no longer knows how to take warning. The youth may have come from prison to the kingship, and that's happened in, like, Kenyatta. What's his name in South Africa? Yeah. They come from prison to kingship. They may have been born in prison within his kingdom. I saw that all who lived and walked under the sun followed the youth. And now later on we're going to be seeing how people who are older have got a lot of experience. So that's one side of it, but there's been other sides where someone should stand down and they don't want to. It's really hard. Like all the jokes they cracked about Reagan and how he'd just off to sleep in the middle of a speech or something. Nancy would give him the right word. Some people stay on too long. And I don't know, in Christian organisations, how many times I've seen a bitter ending to a great life. Someone who had the vision, who had the energy, who got the organisation going, but didn't want to stand down. And the end is sad. And someone said, many begin well, few end well. One of our friends told us about the leader in his organisation. He used to stand up in the council and say, when you think it's time for me to stand down, tell me. And when they did, he was really upset. And it's hard to withdraw gracefully. It might be easier to have all that in the beginning than to see the right time to stand down. Haile Selassie was 83, and they wrote a book, The Famine That Toppled the Kingdom. And they blamed him that people out in the rural provinces were starving to death while he had his dogs and all his, like Solomon, everything, lions in his garden and all this. But he didn't know. He was 83 and those around him did not, they protected him. So that there should have been a standing down, but it suited those in power to keep him there as a puppet. And that's what I think it's saying here, that often it's time to withdraw and not hang around when the new people take over, because it's going to make it harder. SIM had a leader that wouldn't stand down year. He was a great man. He memorised the whole New Testament after he was 65. And all the Psalms. So he had his marbles. But it was time to stand down, and he did it, and they didn't know what to do. So after he did, they made a rule. No one could stay on in leadership after 65, and because they'd had this painful experience. Okay, chapter 5, verse 1. Guard your steps when you go to the house of the Lord. Go near to listen, rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools who don't know that they do wrong. I thought of two ways that we could interpret this. Guard your steps when you go to the house of the Lord. Now, this first interpretation is not in the book, so I'm just making it up. It's when we think of people, Christians, being the temple of the Holy Spirit, that we could look at it that way. Guard your steps when you start intruding into another person's life. If someone wants to talk to you, listen to them. Go near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools, which might be your way of advising or your way of interfering. When we're teaching pastoral care at the Bible College at Croydon, and one of the things that we're giving the most attention to is learning how to listen, waiting, letting that person tell their story, not trying to think, oh, what am I going to say when she finishes, but being willing to hear them out. What we need more than anything else is people who will listen to us and to wait. Wait on the Lord with us, but not try to manoeuvre our lives. We've all got good ideas for other people, but this is a really helpful verse in that area, to guard your steps. And sometimes when if I upset Kath and one of her ideas about me is that I tend to manipulate. My mother manipulates, so it's probably inherited. One time I asked her, did she want a fish on the back of her car, you know, one of those Christian fish, and she said no, and I said why, and she said I don't like them. And I thought, well, you should like them, because when I was saying it, the man used to put petrol in and see the fish and he might wonder what it is, and that's good. Or when you're driving along and you see a fish on someone else's, you think, oh yeah, I'm not the only one on this road. But anyway, she said she didn't want one, and so when she went out, I put one on to help her. So when she came back, she said, I didn't want a fish, and she was really angry, and I said, why are you so angry? She said, I feel like I've been manipulated. Anyway, the fish peeled off the next day. But that was the first time I heard this word manipulate, and in that context, that sometimes when we're having an argument or a good old spat and really being awful to one another, I know I can justify myself to Kath and say, well, this is what I meant, and I was only joking or something. I can make it, but I know in my heart that I went into it with the wrong attitude. And that guarding your step when you go to the house of God, being prayerful as we approach another person and accepting them and being willing to listen, is something that we could all learn a lot about. And I know how many times the Lord has convicted me later. You really knew what you were doing, but you didn't wait on me. But what the commentator's saying is, watch your step when you go into the house of God, because we can take it for granted, the privileges that are ours in a free country. That's what I said before. Why is it that the churches like in Ethiopia are growing, and now our country's saying, well, this is a post-Christian era, that Australia is not seen by the United Nations anymore as a Christian country? And how serious are we about our commitment? And so to see that when we do go into church, that it is a privilege that thousands and thousands of Christians don't have. That in many parts of China, as I said, Iran, the Muslim countries there, they're meeting together in a way that could cost them their lives. And we can go, and where it says, verse 7, much dreaming and many words are meaningless, therefore stand in awe of God. And I thought about the way I doodle on the program and, you know, draw drawings and think, wow, this is a long sermon, and dreaming things and And he is saying that when you go into the house of God, you are going into his presence. Don't be quick with your mouth. Don't be hasty in your heart to utter anything before God. God is in heaven and you are on earth, so let your words be few. That means that when you say, make a commitment to God, make it. Verse 4, when you make a vow to God, do not delay in fulfilling it. He has no pleasure in fools. Fulfill your vow. It is better not to vow than to make a vow and not fulfill it. And David Pawson, speaking on Ecclesiastes, said there was a man in his church who came every Sunday and never sang any hymns, just stood there. And one day, it got too much for David Pawson, and he said, why aren't you singing the hymns? And he spoke in this beautiful English accent, David Pawson, but anyway. And the man said, because I refuse to sing what I don't mean. And at the moment, I don't mean it. And one day, he opened his mouth and sang. And it was, take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee. And David Pawson said, and God asked this man to give up his job, and he and his wife took over a children's home. But he meant it when he sang it. But so often, I think of that when I survey the wondrous cross, were the whole realm of nature mine, that were an offering far too small. Love so amazing, so divine, demands my life, my whole, my all. And yet we sing it so often and forget God is listening. When you make a vow to God, don't delay in fulfilling it. He has no pleasure in fools. And we're going to tomorrow look at this word fool, but it's looking at people that can't live in the way that God wants them to. And I'm reading now verse 10. Whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. As goods increase, so do those who consume them. And what benefit are they to the owner except to feast his eyes on them? The sleeper of a labourer is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of a rich man permits him no sleep. I have seen a grievous evil under the sun, wealth hoarded to the harm of its owner, or wealth lost through some misfortune, so that when he has a son, there is nothing left for him. Naked a man comes from his mother's womb. And as he comes, so he departs. He takes nothing from his labour that he can carry in his hand. This too is a grievous evil. As a man comes, so he departs. And what does he gain? Since he toils for the wind all his days, he eats in darkness with great frustration, affliction and anger. And as I read that, I thought of Luke 12 and how Jesus took this same thought. Someone said once, where there's a will, there's a family feud. And this happened between two brothers in Luke 12. Someone in the crowd said to Jesus, teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. And Jesus seemed to really react to that. He said, and see, in Israel in those days, it would be land. And it was very hard for them always to divide the land. You can imagine it might be a house, and they never sold the land. It wasn't like they could sell it and split the money and buy something somewhere else, because that land went down through the generations. And so this might be a beautiful stream in one part, or the buildings in one part, and it was very hard for them to divide it up. But there were judicial systems set up for them to do it. There was no right. He had no right to ask Jesus to do that, because he had the wherewithal in his own culture. And Jesus said, man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you? Then he said to them, watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. A man's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. And he told them this story. The ground of a certain rich man produced a good crop. This is Luke 12:16. He thought to himself, what shall I do? I have no place to store my crops. Then he said, this is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones. And there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of goods laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink and be merry. But God said, you fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? And so Jesus told this story about this man who sat alone in his house wondering how to store his wealth. He didn't invite his friends in and say, look, it's great, let's have a party and enjoy it. Or he didn't think, well, I'm going to give a tenth to the Lord because he's been so good to me. We could covet his wealth. Fancy having so much that he had to build bigger storehouses to store it. But we could pity his aloneness because he had no plans at all to share. He just determined to invest it for his future. His dream, as he sat there dreaming, he could see these great big barns, fields, that he wouldn't have to work again. He would just have enough for the rest of his life. And so he would say, I'll eat, drink and be merry. And then God said, you fool, what good is your wealth to you? Tonight you will die. And as I said before, the richness of life comes from the people that we love, from being close to God and the things that he teaches us. So Jesus ended up that parable as he talked to those two fellows that were arguing over the will. This is how it will be with anyone who stores up things for himself but is not rich towards God. And so one of the ways that we can think about this, we want to apply this, what we've been talking about, to our own lives, is thinking of what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount. Don't store up treasures on earth where rust and moth destroy, but let your treasure be in heaven. No one can take that away from you. Enjoy. It doesn't say anywhere in the Bible, don't enjoy what God gives you. Don't enjoy the beauty of the world. Don't enjoy what you've got. But hold it in open hands before God, because we don't know what lies ahead. We don't know what tomorrow will bring. But when we build on the foundation of Christ, as it says in 1 Corinthians 3, 11, to build in gold and silver and precious stones, these are things that can never be taken away. These are the things that we give to the Lord. These are the ways that we invest in other people's lives. These are the way that we see God working in people's lives who need him. That will never be taken away. That is real treasure. That is treasure in heaven. That is having things in perspective. Cass said today that our light affliction, which is but for a moment, is working for us a far exceeding weight of glory while we look at the things that are not seen. Because it's so easy to be bogged down in the things that are seen. And so, as we go on in Ecclesiastes, this man's saying, what is real to you? What do you believe? Are you sure you believe it? Or do you just think you do? When it's tested, where really is your treasure? Where are your hopes? Where are your priorities? Get your priorities straight.